Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as you may have heard on Morning Edition and The Takeaway today, Richard Florida has a new book out. The author of The Rise of the Creative Class writes about how the recession we've just been through, or really are still going through, at least in the area of jobs, is changing, resetting, he calls it, the American economy, and the more mobile, better educated among us will come out on top. The book is The Great Reset, How New Ways of Living and Working Drive Post-Crash Prosperity, and Richard Florida joins us now to talk specifically about this region, how it might fare in the new economic order he sees coming, and how to make it fare as well as possible. Well, Richard Florida, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here. It's great to be here live and in person with you.
After we've done how many phone interviews over the years.
It's really nice to be here in person.
So from what I gather in the book, you're pretty bullish on New York City, despite the economic crash that's caused so many jobs here, correct?
Yeah, the book really came out of the cover story I did a year ago, a year and a half ago for the Atlantic Monthly. And it's funny because the backstory there was a fellow named Don Peck, who's an editor there, called me up when the crash happened. He said, we have to do something on New York and how bad it's going to be. And I said, okay, because I like The Atlantic. It's one of my favorite magazines. I've written for them. When I looked at the information, it became quite clear to me that, in fact, as bad as it was in New York, New York had this and when I say New York, not only the city, the whole metropolitan area, region, greater New York, has had this great rebounding capability. So I talked about that in the essay, and when I got to write the book, New York became one of the case studies of not only in this current resetting, but in previous resets, great crises, it has always remade itself. So it was kind of the core argument behind the whole book.
But how much of the bouncing back in New York historically has just been because Wall Street bounces back and bounces back? I mean, look what happened after the last couple of recessions. We got to this the point of this bubble, Wall Street making more money than ever before, even though as a sector in the number of jobs, it was starting to shed jobs to other parts of the country, other parts of the world. Maybe now with a great reset, that cycle is never going to come around again for Wall Street.
Well, I certainly think it was time for Wall Street to take a step back. I remember several years ago talking to one of the heads of an investment bank that will remain nameless today, and I sort of said, well, how is the housing prices, appreciation, all of this craziness affecting your ability to attract people from around the world? He looked at me, said, Rich, we're the cause of the housing bubble. It doesn't affect us. I think New York has always been caught in this tension, like London also. A great financial center that grows perhaps too large. And Tom Philippon, the great economist at NYU, has studied this as that financial center distorts and gets bigger than usual during these bubble periods. But I think when I looked at both New York and London, you really find that underneath it, they're innovative, entrepreneurial, talent-attracting, creative, use a word I've used before, centers. And I think when New York is at its best, it's really a place that fires on all creative cylinders. And I think many people were worried back in the 90s and the early 2000s that it was becoming a financial place and maybe a little bit over-gentrified and a little bit over-yuppified, to turn a phrase. And I think now that what the reset, at least when I thought about it initially, it's bringing that back into balance.
But why are you so generally critical of finance in the book? You say it siphons off resources from where we need them. Aren't finance workers some of the higher paid, highly educated workers, even innovators, even though if we think some of the securities innovation is now grotesque, the very kinds of workers that you say that we need more of and that New York has always been a magnet for?
Yeah, and even though there's been big layoffs in the financial industries in New York, when I look at the statistics nationally, I think the unemployment rate for financial professionals never went much above 5% when a guy in manufacturing is facing an 18% and construction at 25%. But what I say in the book, a friend of mine, Jeff Beattie, who runs a big investment vehicle in Canada, he had a beautiful way of putting this. He said there's in an economy, there are builders and there's traders. And he said what he thought happened in the U.S. is we became too much of a trading economy in the 2000s and not enough of a building economy. I'm not critical of finance qua finance, and actually I'm a big supporter of things like venture finance and investing in new enterprise. I think what happened is finance changed and became less building and more trading, and we just need to get back. It's got to shrink a little, like Philippon says. It's got to go back to where it's been calibrated. But I think it's got to get back to being part of a building society rather than trading for trading's sake.
Richard Florida, my guest on WNYC. His new book, The Great Reset, How New Ways of Living and Working Drive Post-Crash Prosperity. And listeners, do you agree with Richard Florida that we're in a great reset as opposed to simply a cycle? Are you a part of that? Try your hand at trend spotting if you want. Where do you think most of us will be in 20 years, working at Best Buy, making artisanal pickles and Red Hook? And how are you resetting your own life, your own career for the new normal? 212-433-WNYC. Give us a call for Richard Florida, 212-433-9692, or post your comments or questions to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. So where do we start at a policy level? What should the mayors of New York and Newark, where you grew up, and the other cities in our region or counties in our region be doing now to plan for the future?
Well, I think a couple things. And yeah, I was born in Newark, and then my parents suburbanized. I say that euphemistically. I grew up in a working-class suburb called North Arlington, went to Queen of Peace High School there. And then I'll tell you what changed my life for folks listening in is I got a Garden State scholarship to Rutgers and really took me out of a working-class town. And I could be smart, which is an amazing thing in a working-class town. If I was smart, people hit me. They got in a fight. But in Rutgers, I could be smart. And then I went to graduate school at Columbia. So before going off to now live in Toronto. I think one of the things that Mayor Bloomberg did right after the crash was very interesting, and I followed it very closely because he's really the one guy who did this and his administration. He said, you know, we have to make New York City a place for entrepreneurs, and we have to get back, you know, everything's in a garage, right, in a loft. But we have to get back to, because the real estate's gone so expensive, to making sure those flexible spaces that Jane Jacobs wrote about, those garages are there. I think that's very important. I think making sure that we have affordable rental housing, obviously, I mean, during a reset, making sure that we have the kind of education and learning. I talk about this in the book, that resets really involve changing the way we educate people, and inventing new ways of doing that, making sure our infrastructure is up to speed. And I think in this region, making sure we're connected through all sorts of rail, and of course, it's subway when we need to, path, but also high-speed rail. I think those are the things. And what I find, Brian, the mayors get this, whether it's Mike Bloomberg or Cory Booker or, you know, John Hickenlooper in Denver, or Gavin Newsom in San Francisco, on and on. They get it. I think it's the federal policymakers, and you were talking about this before. Mm-hmm. It's a dysfunction in Washington. You know, I can almost, when I talk to a mayor, I can't tell who's a Republican and who's a Democrat. But I go to Washington where I live, then it's just polarization. So I think the mayors see it. It's building from the ground up. It's leveraging productivity. It's investing in innovation, letting people be entrepreneurs. And then finally, and we're doing this in Toronto, and I hope folks in the Bloomberg administration, the Booker administration here pick this up. I challenged the mayor of Toronto, and I said, you know, 60% of our jobs are in low-wage service. Yeah, we have creative jobs and high-tech jobs and bank jobs, but boy, oh boy, 60% of our jobs – you know, 60 million Americans work in these service, low-end jobs. We've got to make them good jobs, and we can do it. We can increase the pay and make them more effective. I think that's an area that mayors really need to focus on and city officials is how do we turn the service jobs into good family-supporting jobs? And I talk about that in the book, actually.
Well, let's take a phone call from somebody who I think is not entirely buying this. Mike in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to say I think there was no reset in places like New York and San Francisco, and that's a problem. In other words, there was a huge bailout of the banking industry, which I think had to be done, but I think the way in which it was done allowed people who I don't think we want to reward to still drive real estate prices to where they still are and unaffordable for a lot of the creative people you're talking about.
Yeah, I agree with your sentiment. And in fact, in the book, I opened the book. If you take a look at it online or at thegreatreset.com, where you can find it free, I say we got to get over our national addiction to bailing out old industries and people who are taking risks and bets. And I think, in a way, you're right. We've coddled far too much. I've argued against that, and people have been quite PO'd at me for arguing against the auto bailout and the financial bailout. My hope is, though, now as that's done, and hopefully done forever, we'll begin to see more of this resetting. I also agree with you and have been blogging on this, that actually real estate prices have stayed up relatively more in places like the New York metro area or greater Washington, D.C., or even Los Angeles than they have in places like Detroit or Cleveland. But I hope that people are getting this. And I think what I'm talking about is not just a national reset. It's as all of us like Mike and you and I and Brian, and we take a look at our lives and how we want to live and raise our families, we begin to see that there's a different path and a better path, that it's not just about material consumption and housing and cars. And I think we are finally at that point. I hope we're at that point of introspection. But this is a generational process. It's not a process that's going to be over in a year or two. But
well,
thank you for that.
I'm fine with the introspection, but as long as inequality keeps increasing in the country, you can talk all you want about taking yoga classes and, you know, going vegetarian. But, you know, I think a lot of people are really pissed off. And hopefully the hearings going on now in the Congress will get to some of this. But, you know, it's fine to talk about all of this, but you still have to pay for your kids' college. And college becomes more expensive. And, you know, the jobs you're talking about, for example, I mean, it's great to talk about it all. I pray for the country, and I support Barack Obama.
So, Mike, what do you want to do at the policy level?
Well, the first thing I want to do is make sure that we don't think of the bankers that got us into this mess and who failed miserably as being indispensable and somehow being the people we're depending on to get us out of this mess. But, you know, for example, this notion that, you know, the same people that got us here, somehow we can't reduce their pay because we're afraid of losing them, it's absurd on its face. And thinking like that just keeps us mired here. I mean, General Motors is now advertising, for example, that they've paid back their loan, but they're still mostly owned by us.
Because the government has shares.
I think Mike and I share the same sentiment, actually, and I think he's right. And I think he's absolutely right. We have a level of economic and social inequality in this country that is grotesque. And I think one of the things our policymakers neglect, and they want to paper this over, it's a geography of class, not just an abstract construct. We have certain places that are becoming far more well-off and certain places that are falling behind. New York is pulling ahead, and San Francisco are pulling ahead of Detroit or Phoenix or St. Louis. But even in these centers like New York, we see levels of inequality that we've never seen before. So you're absolutely right. At the policy level, I think there's an answer. It's not only regulating the banks. How are we going to deal with this inequality? We got to take the 65 million bad jobs we have in services, and we have to make them good jobs. We cannot make 65 million people toil in low-wage jobs they can't afford to feed a family. And here's what my dad told me. My dad left school in Newark in the seventh grade when he was 13. He had to get a job in a factory, Victory Optical, in the down-neck, iron-bound section. He said, Rich, when I took that job, it took nine of us. Your grandfather, my grandmother worked in a bakery, and the six siblings and me, brothers and sisters, we all worked to make one family wage. He said, I served in World War II. He was an infantry soldier in the Army. I came back from World War II, and as if by magic, now there was the Wagner Act and unionization, as if by magic, my job became a good job. I could buy a house and put you two boys through school. We can make jobs good jobs again in this country. And it's not just about recreating manufacturing jobs. It's about making those service jobs, and we can joke. Those jobs in the Best Buys, the retail shops, the dry cleaners, we got to make them big. And we can't offshore those jobs. Many of those jobs are required to be here, and we have to make them good jobs.
Mike, thanks a lot for calling
in.
My guest is Richard Florida, author of The Great Reset, How New Ways of Living and Working Drive Post-Crash Prosperity. From our comments page, William in Williamsburg, writing about that area of Brooklyn in particular. We have it all here in Williamsburg, Greenpoint, except the possibility of a sustainable environment for growth and innovation. All the young techies, musicians, artists, creatives want to come and stay here, but new zoning, unimaginative governance, and a total lack of planning are turning North Brooklyn into an inner-ring commuter suburb instead of the vibrant, cultural, economic engine of the new global city. And in fact, before you even answer that, I think we have a related comment from Joe in Spring Valley. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi, Brian.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I see a guest talking about, really this pie in the sky. He's saying make these service-oriented jobs good jobs. I mean, those are surveys of low-paying jobs anyway. I wrote to the White House, and I got a call back from the White House. As an economist, I can create 16.2 million jobs. All you have to do is impose 10% tariff on Chinese goods coming in, cheap goods, and the apparel, shoes, textile. If you manufacture just 10, 50% of these goods that we consume, we can create 16.2 million jobs paying from $15 to $30 an hour. And those are the jobs that we need because it produces an item, a tangible item, not paper on paper that's produced on Wall Street.
Joe, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you. So we really have two different things on the table here, actually. With respect to Williamsburg and Brooklyn as an emerging suburb rather than a, you know, economically creative engine?
Well, I think he's right. And, you know, you read this great New York magazine. And actually, it's funny because they did a lot of the same things I did in a previous book where I tried to rate neighborhoods by life stage. And this young guy, Nate Silver, did a fabulous job of rating and ranking, right? You know this.
He was on to talk
and,
about that.
And when the Brooklyn neighborhoods, I mean, so many of them came up as the best places to live. I think he's right that these neighborhoods, these what we call the inner rings, are so desired. You know, when I wrote about this, I called them the Strollerbergs, the Strollervilles, the young creatives, the hipsters, and everyone were being displaced by the young families who wanted to be closer in because they wanted to be closer to work and activity. I think it's a balance, and I do think he's right, though, that the building restrictions and zoning restrictions and the old building techniques are acting against a much more sustainable economy. And I talk about this in the book. I think it's going to be people in neighborhoods. I don't think it's a top-down government program. People in neighborhoods, you call this pie in the sky, who are saying, I want a different life. I want to live in a – and you can do it. I live in that community in Toronto. And I think every New Yorker, as much as Toronto can learn a lot from New York, I'd say every New Yorker, get up there and take a look. We have families. We have creatives. We have immigrants. We have low-income people and high-income people living – don't get me wrong. There's some richer neighborhoods and some poorer neighborhoods. We have our issues. But it's a much more balanced approach, and I think New York can learn something, and I think he's right. That's where we have to do it, in those inner communities.
And to Joe in Spring Valley's point about resetting along manufacturing lines, manufacturing continues to flee this area, certainly some of it for overseas, and maybe some of that is not retrievable. But one of the big debates here, it's an exasperating, unending debate, is about tax rates. And that if New York continues to have the high taxes that it does, if New Jersey continues to have the high taxes that it does, then the manufacturers who have lots and lots of choice, if they don't go to Mexico or Shanghai, they're going to go to Birmingham, Alabama.
I'm a couple of minds on this. One, I'm old enough to remember when Soho was a manufacturing area and where there was a Soho south of Houston Manufacturers Council trying to protect that from the incursion of artists, believe it or not. My dad, I watched my dad's factory, which employed hundreds of men, Italians like us, Polish, German, Puerto Rican. I watched my dad's factory. I used to go to work with him, right? We didn't have Take Your Son Day, but I used to beg him, and on Saturday he'd take me into the factory, Victory Optical. I watched that factory die and become boarded up, and I watched all of that go away because it couldn't compete. Now, I think there's some things we can do in manufacturing. They made eyeglasses. If we had design and, you know, the kind of frames that people want to consume here and spend a lot of money for, yes, we can sell those things. But increasingly, manufacturing has shifted abroad. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of protectionism. I have to admit, I'm enough of an economist to understand that protectionism doesn't help people.
So give up on manufacturing. Create new economy jobs.
Well, I think we can do some manufacturing, but it's got to be very high-end. It's got to be design-intensive. It's got to be more artisanal and adding creativity. I think mass manufacturing.
But there aren't mass jobs in that, right? The whole industrial era was based on a mass number of jobs the manufacturing.
And those are moving abroad. And I think it's
so where are the mass jobs to come out of these artisanal?
The only mass jobs we're going to create in this economy are service jobs. And we can't, you know,
failure by definition?
No.
People working at Costco?
That's a fabulous question. You know, if you look back 100 years, if you go back to Karl Marx's time, right, to invoke a great thinker, people were saying these manufacturing jobs were the scourge of the earth. This was work, as William Blake called it, in the satanic mills. It not only paid low, you couldn't support a family, you were not only alienated, you were maimed and cooked in the steel mills. We turned them. As a country, with public policy, with unions, we turn them into good jobs. We cannot give up on 60 million people. There is a way to use the techniques that have upgraded manufacturing, lean manufacturing, continuous improvement, engaging workers' intelligence to make those service jobs more productive and higher paying. Absolutely.
We're going to run out of time in a minute. We have clips to play this hour, we think, from Fabrice Touré from Goldman Sachs.
Oh, my.
The Wunderkind trader on the hot seat now in congressional testimony. And we're going to go on to the personal reset of our Help Wanted series, our radio series and Facebook community for people looking for work today on the teaching profession, still expected to be a big growth industry in our area. And this is going to be a very practical segment for people who think maybe you want to become a teacher. What kind of teacher should you become? How is the best way to get trained, a traditional education school or something else? But let me sneak in one more caller for Richard Florida, author of The Great Reset. And it's Oscar in Manhattan. Oscar, thanks a lot for calling.
Yes, good morning. I like what your guest is saying. I am from Eastern Europe. I've been here 40 years, and I've seen the economy change. The global economy and the scalability trap of this value-added manufacturing and the fact that you have so much immigration here. You say you are from Toronto. In this country, you have about 160,000 people coming in every month legally to the labor market.
And, Oscar, I'm going to cut you short just because we're running out of time fast. This goes to the big immigration debate that Arizona and everybody else is having right now. Where are you on
that? Every great reset has seen America step up. And when the world closed its borders for totalitarianism and fascism, we said, come here. My dad told me this in World War II.
Why is it a matter of basic economics, supply and demand? Wages are going to go lower.
I don't buy it.
Uneducated workforce coming in. And I realize there are a lot of educated immigrants, too. But the mass influx that they're having trouble with in Arizona is largely uneducated, and that just drags the whole enterprise
on balance down. Immigration has been an enormous plus for our society. Of course, there are issues that we have to deal with, but we can't do it in this crisis. One last thing. Education is a growth industry of the future. It's very important what you're doing.
Anything in particular to say about that? Do you like this challenge to the education schools that we're going to talk about from alternative pathways?
Absolutely. And I think we got to, you know, Peter Drucker once said about where I teach, the research university, it's not going to survive the transition to knowledge-based capitalism. Every reset has seen us remake our education system, do better at educating people, both at the basic level and the highest levels. We have to reinvent education more than the public school system and the modern university combined. This is a major rethink and reset with education right at the cusp of it. I applaud what you're doing on that.
Richard Florida, his new book, The Great Reset, How New Ways of Living and Working Drive Post-Crash Prosperity. Great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.